Welcome to this week's Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The end of daylight savings time will soon be upon us, an annual event we may not necessarily welcome, but to which we've become so accustomed that we seldom take time to consider its origins or purpose. Not so on Talking History. We never let historical origins go unexplored. So for this week's interview, Dennis Mihalik will discuss this and other subjects related to the history of time with historian Michael O'Malley. But first, let's look back at this week, October 19th through the 25th, in history. On October 19th, 1944, the U.S. Navy allowed black women to become WAVES, women accepted for volunteer emergency service in World War II. On October 20th, the Senate ratified the Louisiana Purchase and for $15 million doubled the size of the United States. Princeton University, then known as the College of New Jersey, was chartered on October 22nd, 1746. The Senate passed a nearly $6 billion Lend-Lease Bill on October 23rd, 1941, taking the nation one step closer to involvement in World War II. And on October 24th, 1929, Black Thursday, the day the stock market crashed, marked the beginning of the Great Depression. Turning to this week's history in the news, medical scientists, geographers, and historians are teaming up to dig for clues to the flu virus of 1918 that killed more than 20 million people. By exhuming the remains of seven flu victims buried in frozen ground in Norway, researchers hope to understand why the mysterious virus became one of the most lethal of its kind in history. Similarly, physicians and historians are working together to reveal the origin of a rare genetic mutation that resists infection by the AIDS virus. Researchers suspect the mutation began with the survivors of the bubonic plague that wiped out a third of Europe's population in the 1300s. And finally, the Norwegian Highway Department is building a pedestrian bridge designed by Leonardo da Vinci in 1502. Rejected at the time as an impossible structure, modern architects now praise the design as the perfect blend of art and function. You are listening to Talking History. Spring ahead, fall back. Whoever dreamed up such a system and why? Well, in a few days, as you begin your semi-annual ritual of walking around the house, resetting your clocks, maybe you can relieve some of the tedium by recalling the following interview in which Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik talks to Michael O'Malley on the history of time.
Thank you, Brian. This coming weekend, in 48 of the 50 states, Americans will set their clocks back 1 hour as daylight savings time comes to an end. Daylight savings time is just one of a number of controversial concepts regarding time that have been introduced in the last 150 years. Here today to explain the agonizing historical transition to the reliance on clocks is Dr. Michael O'Malley, Associate Professor of History at George Mason University and the author of Keeping Watch, A History of American Time, available from the Smithsonian Press. Welcome, Dr. O'Malley.
Thank you.
Well, let's just jump right into our topic. When and why was daylight savings time introduced?
Well, daylight saving was first introduced about a decade before World War I. Although it didn't become law in the United States until World War I. In fact, that's the simple answer, the war. World War I was the reason daylight saving was introduced anywhere in the world. It was first tried by the United States in 1917, and the experiment lasted officially a year, and then it was repealed.
Mm-hmm.
Thereafter, it was by local adoption. Some places had it, and some places didn't.
Okay. Now, you say the concept actually for the war.
Well, there are some people who trace it to Ben Franklin, who makes a kind of joking, in one of his letters, he makes a joking suggestion that in France, in Paris, they change their clocks and then they'll save candlelight. They'll use less candles because they'll think it's 8 o'clock when it's actually 7. And he's joking about it. It's taken up again by a man named William Willett, manufacturer and golfer, and he introduces the idea as a kind of a crazy hobby, I guess, or a sort of personal obsession. And he actually published a pamphlet about this, which caught on in the United States right around the time of World War One, partly because there's a generalized obsession with efficiency and maximizing output and conservation in the progressive era.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, what was going to be conserved with daylight savings time?
Well, it's an interesting case because fuel for the war effort, on the one hand, because people will use less artificial light. And the other argument is that people would grow victory gardens. Instead of going home and going inside, they'd have an extra hour of daylight, and they'd be out there growing vegetables or fruits or whatever for the war effort. And that's how it was sold to the public, as an energy-conserving measure and as a measure that would allow you to do more sort of patriotic gardening. Although when it was first introduced, the first day of daylight saving, there was no talk about gardening. There was mostly talk about how wonderful it is to have this extra time after work for playing baseball.
Ah.
But that was, you know, baseball, softball, walking in the park. And that's one of the more interesting things about it, is that although it's supposed to be about conservation, the real talk about it and how great it is to have everybody outside and enjoying the extra hour.
I see. So you say it was then repealed, so that obviously indicates people benefited and some people suffered or didn't like it.
Well, let me say first, the real engine behind daylight saving was not really conservation. It was never whatsoever. The real push for it came from businesses, a number of businesses that clearly realized that they stood to gain by daylight saving. The most prominent was probably A. Lincoln Filene, who ran the Filene chain of department stores in New England. Anyway, in fact, the major impetus, there is still a extending the time of their money during daylight saving. Filene realized that people would be much more likely to go down to the store and do some shopping if they could walk home in daylight. It's still true today, for example. People are much more likely to go up to the 7-Eleven and get that quart of milk if it's still daylight outside. But once it's dark, they tend to stay inside. So the real push was always from commercial interests that stood to gain. And the opposition, not surprisingly, was from people who were either distant from those kinds of commercial interests, or opposition in 1918 came from farmers. There were a fair number of rural people who wrote into newspapers or wrote their congressmen. In fact, I have a lot of letters from to Congress from people objecting to daylight saving because they were sync with the rest of society. They felt themselves to be put out of... out of sync is maybe the best way to put it. Sometimes their letters were expressed in terms of that this is a crime, that time belongs to God, that you can't change the clock. The clock is a reflection of nature, and you're tampering with nature. There's one of my favorite quotes is from a congressman from Iowa who gets up and denounces daylight saving as a lie. It's false. Let us return to the truth, he says, as it's written in the sun, moon, and stars. There's a certain amount of that kind of a reaction, since the clocks aren't really showing. They were showing standard time at that point anyway. But traded, it's not just farmers and it's not just rural people. The AFL, the American Federation of Labor, let's say you work in a mine and you have to get up extremely early for work, and when you get out, you're tired and you want to go to bed. Not too long after you get out, you work a long day. Well, daylight saving, you're always getting up in darkness, and it's harder for you to sleep because it's late, it's light longer, people are out, the light is keeping you up. Miners wrote in that it was a very, very early, and daylight saving works a hardship on them, they felt, because it means they get up in darkness all year round.
Mm-hmm. And sleep on the subway on the way to work.
Right, exactly, right. Yeah. Right. But it wasn't just farmers. There's a geographic lot of rural objections, but I can go into that if you like.
Yes.
It's most of the objections were low order of a time zone, because if you imagine that noon on the East Coast, about the same time as noon in Washington by the sun. It's just about the time that the sun is directly over between East or Cleveland or Cincinnati. You were on the far end of the Eastern time zone, and you were all by the sun and noon by the clock. And daylight saving could put some places nearly 2 hours of what we... And at that point, people seemed to feel a certain kind of lack of synchronization. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. Most of the objections came from people who noticed a very extreme difference between local noon and the time that the clock showed.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's one of the most important transitions in terms of our modern use of setting time, that is, looking at our watch.
Right.
And this transition took place in the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution. Could you explain that transition from natural to clock time?
Sure. There are clocks for hundreds of years in Europe, but they're relatively rare, and they're almost always in town. And they generally, they aren't particularly accurate, and they're generally set to the sun in the local area. In the mid-19th century, roughly the mid-19th century, it becomes possible to mass-produce clocks and watches very cheaply, so that almost anyone can afford one. But still, most people, when they do, they set it with an almanac. Almanacs are very popular in America early on, and people seem to check them a lot. They synchronize their life to the tables in the almanac, or they use them as a kind of predictor of the natural world. And when they get clocks or watches, at first they seem to set them to the local sun. As late as, I think it's about 1872, there are about 65 different time zones in operation in America, different places keeping local times. Before 1883, in fact, officially every city, town, village, farmhouse in America kept its own standard of time. And the real reason that changes is the railroads, as they begin to, the railroads and the telegraph, as it becomes possible to move quickly or communicate quickly between different places east to west, you begin to notice the difference of time. If you're doing business by telegraph with someone in Cincinnati and you're in New York, you begin to notice that there's close to a half an hour difference between the two places. It starts to matter in commerce. It starts to matter, say, in things like the expiration of a contract or the closing of an exchange, things like that. Railroads begin to be concerned with synchronizing their schedules and making sure that where, say, two lines meet, they're both running on the same time. It would sometimes be it was said that in Buffalo, New York, there were five different times prevailing. When you got out of the station, there was a time for each one of the train lines that used the station, and there was a time for Buffalo City. So you'd have these five different times going, New York, Philadelphia, let's say Cleveland, Pittsburgh. You'd have to compare all these different times. The real change is on November 18th, 1883, when the railroads simply announced that they're going to adopt four new time zones, and that everyone else can do as they please, but the railroads are now going to run on Eastern Time, Central Time, Pacific Time.
So the owners of the major railroads in the United States got together and decided this?
Not even the owners. It's actually the management. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's the middle managers. There are a lot of people who've remarked that the key to the Industrial Revolution is not so much the entrepreneurial owner as it is the management, the middle management that works out the infrastructure. It's an association of manufacturers who send delegates to work out things like couplers on cars or signal systems. How do you standardize signal systems so everybody knows what stop means, for example? And they elect a program, a plan for national standard time. And they're worried at first. They say, well, why will anyone listen? And several of them point out, well, we're the major source of time in the country. We're what the country runs by. We're going to adopt this, and they're going to follow. And as it turns out, that's largely right. But It's introduced on November 18th, 1883, and it was referred to at the time as the Day of Two Noons, because there are two noons on that day.
How's that, two noons?
Well, the regular noon happens, and then the railroads, at the railroad station, set their clocks to the new time, which generally was back of the original noon. So you'd have one noon, and then you'd have a second one. So that the noon would come twice. There were there were jokes and things like that in newspapers. The New York Times wrote that if someone slipped on a banana peel at the right moment, he'd have 15 minutes longer to fall before he hit the ground because of the change standard time.
Oh, I see. Now this standardized. I mean, the railroads started it, but most of us understand this. Greenwich, and then with longitudes, you measure all the way around the world.
Right.
When did that come about?
It's one of the reasons the railroads adopt the standard time measures is because scientists are beginning to work on some kind of world time standard. I'm sure you've all noticed that when you, if you look at the border between the eastern and the central zone, for example, it's not even. It goes all over the place. It goes back and forth from county to county. It doesn't have a sort of objective scientific precision. The international scientific community had been working for some time in the mid-19th century to introduce some standardization of time. Partly it's for things like weather observations, so that you know if someone cables you that I'm here in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's raining, and it's 78 degrees, you know what he means, and it's noon, you know what he means by noon. Where he says, 2 o'clock, a thunder shower has just moved through, you need to chart that front. And the Weather Service wants to have uniform standard time, and there are mapping agencies that want to have uniform standard time. So the scientific community had actually been arguing for uniform world standards, and the railroads were partly worried about that. They didn't want to adopt a time system that wasn't of their own making, and they saw this coming and adopted their own plan. And there are memos back and forth between railroad managers saying, if we don't do this now, the government is going to come up with a plan that we'll have to live with, and it'll cause us more trouble and expense.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the government actually come up with a plan eventually?
No, they. I think the people who were most active in this recognized that they were going to have to work with the railroads.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wouldn't. And the measure that eventually passed, it's quite interesting. There's no law requiring standard time. Standard time is introduced by the railroads, but it's not given the force of law. It's just general custom.
I see.
No one's compelled to adopt it.
Okay, what about daylight savings time to kind of square the circle here? All 50 states don't follow it. What's the standard there?
The standard was, after World War I, when it was repealed, the standard was that individual states could adopt it if they chose. And so it was adopted locally, kind of impressionistically, although I think it was in general use. It was in pretty general use until 1966, when there was a law making it the law.
Mm-hmm.
It's exempted by part of Indiana and by Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I only have anecdotal evidence for this, but the argument is that in Arizona, the reason there's no daylight saving is partly a campaign by the owners of drive-in movie theaters, who at the time recognized that their business would be destroyed by daylight saving. And, of course, you don't see many drive-in movie theaters anymore.
Or the triple feature would be getting out very, very late.
Very, very late. Exactly.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. That's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Michael O'Malley of George Mason University, for this fascinating insights into the concepts of time.
Time. Does it mean the same thing to women as men? Have changes in technology affected how women use their time in what was once called woman's work or housework? Here to address those questions in our op-ed of the week is Ruth Cowan, professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Her remarks are based on her award-winning book, More Work for Mother, The Ironies of Household Technology from the Open Hearth to the Microwave, published by Basic Books in 1983.
I can remember very clearly the moment when I started to worry about time. It was the spring of 1970. I was on maternity leave from my job. I'd just given birth to my first child. I was washing dishes. I had a eureka experience. That's it, I said to myself. When I can finally get back to work, I'm going to do a little study. I'm going to demonstrate that modern household technology has reduced the time spent in housework. 13 years passed before I actually published the book about time and housework that I began plotting that evening in 1970. And in those 13 years, I learned a lot about saving time. In those years, my husband and I bought a house and a whole host of electrical appliances. But despite all these electrical wonders, I could never make the ends of my own time meet. Each night as I fell into bed, I found myself hoping that the next day and the next day and the one after that would actually be one of those wonderful daylight savings days, the ones with 25 hours in them. Talk about weird. My research was uncovering exactly what I was observing in my own life. Household technology wasn't saving me any time, and it hadn't saved time for my predecessors either. Since about 1910, home economists had been studying the time spent in housework, and when I finally managed to analyze all the data, I discovered that whether a woman lived on a farm or in a city, whether she was rich or poor, whether she lived in 1910 or as I did in 1980, if she was the female head of a family and if she had children, she was spending between 50 and 60 hours a week doing housework. It wasn't easy to figure out why this had happened in the past, or to me. To make a long, complicated story short about the past, rich housewives, over the course of the 20th century, lost their servants. And poor housewives used the time and the technology available to them to improve the quality of their families' lives. To make an equally complicated story about myself short, my research taught me how to rearrange my own time priorities. How ironic that in the end, despite all my training as an historian, historians are, after all, the people who get paid to think about time, it took my own housework and the research project stimulated by my own housework to finally teach me to pay attention to time.
You've been listening to Ruth Cowan, Professor of History at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Professor Cowan's latest book is A Social History of American Technology, published by Oxford University Press in 1997. And this is Talking History. Continuing on the subject of the history of time, Talking History's producer Cindy Workman is here with our site of the week, the place where time begins. Cindy?
An important time is fast approaching, the new millennium, and if you want to be there first, then you need to be at Greenwich in southeast London in England, where the new millennium will start. There are three historic sites located here, the old Royal Observatory, where east meets west and time is set. You can stand on the line where east meets west or set your watch when the ball drops at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There is also the National Maritime Museum, known as one of the finest maritime museums in the world, with a wonderful collection of clocks. There is the Queen's House, which was the model for our White House. Make your plans early if you want to be one of the first in the new millennium.
Thank you, Cindy. And by the way, if you need more time to prepare for the millennium, timekeepers at the United States Naval Observatory have decided that a leap second has to be added at the end of this year to synchronize the nation's official timepiece, which is the observatory's master clock, with actual time as measured by the Earth's rotation. The second will be added on December 31st at 6:59:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Use it wisely. Read your history. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment of Coming Attractions, in which we report on films, television shows, museum exhibits, and anything else that may be of interest to our listeners. This week, TBS will air the first of a four-part series titled Africans in America. The Terrible Transformation explores the arrival of the first Africans on slave ships and the foundations of the slavery system. Future segments will explore the role of blacks in the American Revolution and then the abolition movement. And if that whets your appetite for more information on African Americans, you might check out a new exhibit at the Library of Congress titled The African American Odyssey. The exhibition showcases over 200 items, including literature, music, films, and photographs relating to the life, culture, and history of African Americans. Check your local listings or call the Library of Congress for further information on either of these coming attractions. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our special Halloween show. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions for future programming either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.